we found that when we actually go to parliamentarians with an explicitly Christian perspective on these issues, they get the fact that in order to make sound policy decisions, they've got to have a basic understanding of, for example, the purpose of government, who is man, what is humanity, what is our purpose, all these big questions.
As Christians, we often find ourselves inclined to bemoan the erosion of biblical values in our land. With such a mindset, we might very well become blind to the positive developments that are sitting right under our very noses. If, on the other hand, we look for the positives, we might just be surprised at what we find.
A special edition of Lighthouse News this week, a comprehensive look back at the God and Government event in Ottawa earlier this month.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
We're doing something a little bit unusual on this edition of Lighthouse News. Instead of the usual bit of news at the front end and then an interview to close, we'll be closing the program with a full recording of a half-hour speech given by Dr. John Smith at the God and Government Conference in Ottawa last week. In fact, the entire program focuses on that conference. We're starting with Mark Penninga. He's the executive director of ARPA, and Mark is in studio with me. Mark, it's a little bit unusual to our North American ears to even hear the words God and government in the same sentence. We've been quite indoctrinated into this separation of church and state thing. How well did that concept go over at the conference?
It might sound controversial in some of our own ears, and yet we found that when we actually go to parliamentarians with an explicitly Christian perspective on these issues, they aren't surprised, and neither do they actually challenge us on bringing a religious perspective, because they get it. They get the fact that in order to make sound policy decisions, they've got to have a basic understanding of, for example, the purpose of government, who is, you know, man, what is humanity, what is our purpose, all these big questions. And so when we come at it from an explicitly Christian perspective, they appreciate that, because they know that no matter what issue it is, even if it's something like prostitution or the economy, it's going to have some worldview guiding it. When we bring this Christian perspective to Parliament, we find that there isn't actually much tension there.
So talk to me about the week and some of the activities. I mean, I know we had people from all over the country, different ARPA chapters were there, you know, presenting to different members of Parliament. Do we have some indication roughly of, you know, how many presentations and how that all went?
It was quite amazing. We had meetings with at least 50 members of Parliament on the Tuesday. So after a brief orientation session, we all went out. We split up into groups of about 3 people in a group, sometimes a little more or less, and we then went straight into the offices of the MPs. Now, of course, we had booked these meetings ahead of time. We gave them an idea of what we wanted to talk about, and then we were able to have some pretty in-depth and personal conversations. Again, these meetings were a wide variety of topics and a wide variety of leaders as well, everyone from the Green Party leader, Elizabeth May, to some Conservative MPs whom we have built relationships with for 7 years already. Very successful meetings.
I was reading some of the stuff online, both at the ARPA website and in some of the Facebook, you know, ongoing social media streams that came out of there. And some of the MPs or some of the delegates who went to see members of Parliament, you know, wrote on their Facebook pages and elsewhere, you know, this particular MP doesn't want to advance stuff in caucus. He's more a backroom kind of guy who will take it to his party policy convention and bring stuff forward there. Is that kind of the other way that some of this stuff works?
Well, there's different ways of getting at it. What we find is some MPs are generally going to be much more willing to open up with us when we've already built that relationship with them. And they'll tell us a bit more about what they think is most effective. But, you know, just as there's a variety of opinions amongst ourselves here in the general public about what's actually effective, the same is really true of those in government. So some will say, yeah, the way to do it is grassroots. Others will say, get involved through the political party process. Other people say, you know, you really need to run for office yourself. ARPA's approach has always been, look at what skills you've got, look at what interests you have, and then just apply your faith to those areas. All of them can be effective means.
Highlight of the week for you personally. You've done these once or twice, at least. Anything really stand out for you this year?
A few things really stood out. First of all, it was so much more organized than previous years, and that's thanks to the blessing of ARPA simply being a little more mature, having more staff, excellent organization from Nikki Devereaux and Andre Schutten. That made an immense difference to just making this an enjoyable, smooth conference. But then, of course, the highlights also of seeing all these ARPA reps going into the meetings with MPs, feeling comfortable, knowing what's involved. You can tell that there's real growth from previous years, just in understanding how the system works. And then listening to the MPs come back to us and say, boy, do we ever appreciate what you're doing. Even Cabinet Minister Jason Kenney came and did a talk to us during our second day when we were just meeting as ARPA groups. He stayed much longer than he would say, than he had planned to stay, and was very frank and open, saying just how important this kind of contribution is, specifically from a faith-based Christian perspective. He wholeheartedly welcomed that. That would be another highlight. And I'd say a third highlight was just interacting with MPs and other leaders from groups similar to ARPA in the evening presentation when Dr. John Smith spoke to MPs about a biblical perspective on restorative justice. It was really neat to see the hour of socializing afterwards where everyone was very comfortable, very collegial, and just building relationships with the people there in Ottawa.
Mark, thank you very much. Anything else that I forgot to ask or that should be mentioned?
I just want to take my hats off to all those individuals from across Canada. There was almost 70 reps there from the ARPA groups, and they were prepared, they were encouraged, and yeah, it was so neat to see that.
Okay, Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Al.
Also with me today, Mike Schutten from We Need a Law. That's the pro-life division of ARPA, so to speak. Mike, it was quite a week for you folks in Ottawa as well. Prayer service and the big March for Life. Talk to me a little bit about how those things went.
It was pretty exciting to be in Ottawa for the March for Life. I don't make it out there every year, but one of the highlights is definitely the prayer service when over 400 Reformed people are gathered together in a downtown Ottawa church to hear a message obviously pertinent to the issue of that day, and that is the rights of preborn humans. We had Tim Challies there speaking to us about that, gave some history as far as how Wilberforce worked hard, and he just really focused on we have to do what's right as Christians, right, for our neighbors, our preborn neighbors who are created in the image of God just like we are.
And then there's the actual march itself. You know, we don't see much about it in the secular media. I was reading online, some of the social media stuff. 20,000 plus?
Yeah, that's what's been reported, 20 to 23,000. And from my personal experience, I was there 2 years ago. It definitely felt like there was more people there this year.
I hate to ask this, but I have to. I mean, what kind of impact does this really have? Last week, we saw Justin Trudeau come forward and say, if you're pro-life, don't even bother applying to be a candidate for the federal Liberals. You know, every year we're out there, and every year these demonstrations are large. They don't seem to resonate a lot with, you know, Joe average Canadian. If you talk to most people, they have no idea that more than 20,000 people marched in Ottawa last week. How do we turn that around?
You hit the nail on the head there, Al. That's what we're trying to do with this campaign. Essentially, if 20,000 people gather on the Hill for one day and they go home and essentially do nothing for the rest of the year in regards to the pro-life movement, the pro-life cause, we haven't gained any ground. So our campaign is all geared towards giving people tools to engage with their neighbors, with their family members, and most importantly, with government during the rest of the year. And that's the goal, that we can continue to build that groundswell, not just on May 8th or May 10th at the March for Life, but throughout the rest of the year as well. And if we're ever going to get anywhere, we're going to have to show to our politicians that we're serious about it, not just on that one day, but throughout the course of the year as well.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Al.
As Mark Penninga mentioned a few minutes ago, one of the highlights of the week was an address by Dr. John Smith, a professor from the Seminary of the Canadian Reformed Churches in Hamilton, addressing the topic of restorative justice, righting the relational wrongs. As a special feature this week, we have a full recording of Dr. Smith's speech.
This is a good time to address a topic like this because this month marks the 40th anniversary of restorative justice in Canada. Let me take you back to an event that happened back in May of 1974 in the town of Elmira, Ontario. One night, two 18-year-old men got drunk and went on a vandalism spree. They punctured 24 car tires, they slashed car seats, they threw rocks through the windows of people's homes and through the front window of the local beer store. They pulled someone's boat into the street, flipped it over, and punched a hole in it. They damaged a traffic light at an intersection. They wrecked someone's fence. They damaged a gazebo. And they snapped a wooden cross in the front of a local church. 22 properties were damaged in the space of about 2 hours. The two teens were soon arrested, and you can just imagine the outrage in the community. Now, this event made legal history, not because of the crime, but because of the sentence. When the case went to court, the probation officer suggested to the judge that the offenders be told to meet their victims and repair the damage. There was no legal precedent for that at the time. But the judge agreed. So two police officers took the two young men door to door in Elmira. They had to knock on doors, identify themselves, apologize to their victims, and listen to what their victims had to say, and determine the amount of restitution and ask for forgiveness. Now, some of the damage was covered by insurance, but certainly not all of it. So over the next 3 months, the two offenders had to save money to pay for the outstanding amount and then go door to door again with certified checks in hand. They also had to repair the things that money could not replace, such as the cross in front of the church. And besides all of that, they had to pay a fine and they were put on probation for 18 months. This is the first documented case in Canadian legal history of what has now become known as restorative justice. As a result of this case, Canada became the first nation in the world to offer a program that sought reconciliation between victims and offenders. Now, what began as a simple experiment in a local courtroom has blossomed greatly in the four decades since that time. In terms of quantity, a recent survey lists more than 100 restorative programs and projects across Canada, over 300 in the US, and more than 500 in Europe. Canada is also a leader in the academic study of restorative justice. To give an example, in 2002, the Simon Fraser University School of Criminology launched a Center for Restorative Justice. In terms of quality, restorative justice has evolved into a multifaceted and complex process. A tremendous amount of literature is available that spells out its various applications, programs, and strategies in great detail. In this presentation, I intend to do three things this evening. First of all, I will outline what restorative justice is and how it currently fits into Canada's justice system. Secondly, I'm going to explore the roots of restorative justice and evaluate its principles from a Christian biblical perspective. And thirdly, I'd like to offer some reflections and recommendations on the implementation of restorative justice. Let me then briefly mention a few of the distinctive features of restorative justice. First of all, as was mentioned in Andre's introduction, restorative justice does not treat crime simply as a matter of breaking the law. Rather, restorative justice also focuses on the harm that's done to victims and their communities, and the harm, for that matter, that's done to the offenders themselves. Secondly, it gives the offenders, the victims, and their communities a role in the restorative process by arranging face-to-face meetings where victims can talk about the impact of the crime, offenders can take responsibility for their actions, and the two sides can then discuss a plan to repair the damage done, all within a safe environment and with the help of a trained mediator. If such meetings are not possible, restorative programs offer alternative forms of assistance, such as restitution, community service, and other types of assistance. Thirdly, restorative justice measures success not in terms of how much punishment the offender receives, but in terms of how much damage is repaired and prevented. Now let me talk a little bit about how this has featured in Canadian legal history, especially at the higher levels. In 1996, the Criminal Code of Canada was amended to include provisions of restorative justice. It now says, and I quote, "The fundamental purpose of sentencing is to contribute to respect for the law and the maintenance of a just, peaceful, and safe society by imposing just sanctions that have one or more of the following six objectives. A, to denounce unlawful conduct. B, to deter the offender and other persons from committing offenses. C, to separate offenders from society where necessary. D, to assist in rehabilitating offenders. And then I'd like you to notice especially the next two. E, to provide reparations for harm done to victims or to the community. And F, to promote a sense of responsibility in offenders and acknowledgement of the harm done to victims and the community. Furthermore, the Criminal Code now includes provisions for restitution to victims. Most recently, the federal government has announced a Victims' Bill of Rights to address the impact of crime on individuals, their families, and on society at large. In short, aspects of restorative justice are being integrated into Canada's judicial system, at least in the letter of the law. So that raises the question, how was it possible for restorative justice to morph from the brainwave of a single probation officer in small-town Elmira into a global phenomenon that has the attention of criminology departments and parliamentarians? I'm not a social historian, but at the risk of gross oversimplification, I can think of two basic considerations. Number one, it seems to work. Involving victims and their families in the restorative process by allowing them to express how the crime has impacted their lives, and by inviting them to help set the terms for reparation, has led to greater satisfaction among victims that justice is being done. Post-traumatic stress, anger, helplessness, vulnerability, and desire for revenge are all reduced through the constructive outlet that restorative justice provides. Number two, it saves money. The process of taking responsibility for the crime, offering apologies, paying restitution, and joining programs that encourage offenders to change their environment and their behavior has been shown to lower the likelihood that they will re-offend, thereby reducing the strain on prison facilities. In short, then, restorative justice has broad appeal. On the one hand, it speaks to those who are concerned with the well-being of the community, while correcting the extreme view that offenders are merely victims of their circumstances. On the other hand, it appeals to those who emphasize individual responsibility and fiscal restraint, while again correcting the equally extreme view that all offenders should be isolated from the community. In short, the ideals of restorative justice can bring people of very different political stripes together to rethink the goals of the justice system. As one advocate has recently put it, instead of the old ideas about rehabilitation and deterrence, ideas now largely discredited, we need to think in radically different terms about a system that restores the peace of the community shattered by crime. Now, one would hope that the spread of restorative justice is due to more than merely utilitarian or economic considerations. And indeed, practitioners are quick to point out that although restorative justice has only recently begun to be applied to our country's judicial system at the higher levels, it actually has deeper grassroots in the traditional practices of, for example, the Maori people in New Zealand, as well as Native American communities. What's strikingly absent from the literature is any reference to a Christian origin for restorative justice in Canada. Now, in itself, that's okay. Christians are not the only people to come up with good ideas. And yet, one might expect that Christians would have come up with this one. You see, the very idea that a criminal might have a change of heart, express remorse, and ask a victim for forgiveness, the idea that a victim might move beyond fear and rise above hostility to forgive the one who caused suffering and loss, the idea that it might be possible to love one's enemy, is one of the most cherished values of the Christian faith taught by Jesus Christ himself. Christianity prizes the notion of a change of heart on the part of the wrongdoer, and of forgiveness and love on the part of the victim. And yet, restorative justice is beginning to flourish precisely in what is sometimes called the post-Christian era, or at least an era when Christians tend to bemoan the disintegration of our country's Judeo-Christian heritage. As a Christian myself, I find that both intriguing and humbling. Now, while Christians have not always been front and center in promoting the cause of restorative justice in Canada, the principles that underlie it do find support in the Bible. I think, for example, of the restitution laws in the Old Testament law code. God taught his people Israel that they were to show concern for their neighbor's well-being. In Deuteronomy 22, we read, "If you see your brother's ox or sheep straying, do not ignore it, but be sure to take it back to him. Do the same if you find your brother's donkey or his cloak or anything he loses. Do not ignore it. If you see your brother's donkey or his ox fallen on the road, do not ignore it. Help him get it to his feet." An Israelite was also responsible for accidental loss. We read in Exodus 21, "If one man's bull injures another man's bull so that it dies, the owners are to sell the live bull, split the proceeds, and also split the dead animal between them." So each party was left with equal value. The guy with the stronger bull does not benefit. Both suffered the same loss. Now then the passage continues, "If it was known that the bull had the habit of goring, and yet the owner did not keep it penned up, the owner must pay animal for animal, and the dead animal will be his." Now this then was a case of negligence. The owner could have foreseen that an accident might happen, but he failed to take precautions. So he has to pay at a level of one for one, and he also has to do the work of disposing of the dead animal. A step beyond negligence was outright theft. If someone stole an animal and the animal was found alive in his possession, the thief then would have to pay back double. But if the thief had further profited from the crime by selling or slaughtering the animal and therefore could not restore it, then he would have to pay back 5 head of cattle for an ox, or 4 sheep for a sheep. And we find an extreme statement in Proverbs chapter 6. There it says, "People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his hunger when he is starving. Yet, if he is caught, he must pay 7-fold, though it costs him all the wealth of his house." The point there is that even though poverty may have motivated the crime, yet the thief is still held accountable, and his poverty is no excuse for avoiding restitution. On the flip side, willingness to offer restitution was a sign of godly character. Consider for a moment the prophet Samuel. When he retired from public office, he held a speech in front of the people in which he said, "Here I stand, testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these things, I will make it right." There you have a model farewell speech. Now, more passages could be mentioned, but the principles are clear. In the first place, theft not only involves loss of property, but also loss of trust. God legislated restitution as a means to restore both the property and the relationship between the two parties. Secondly, God required different levels of restitution depending on the amount of damage done to the property or to the relationship between the parties concerned. Thirdly, the laws of restitution focus on the responsibility of the wrongdoer. The obligation did not lie, first of all, with the victim to demand restitution, but with the wrongdoer to offer it generously as a way of demonstrating the depth of his remorse and his eagerness to regain his neighbor's trust. Now, I mention these Old Testament laws not to argue that they should remain in force today, but simply to make the point that the essential principles of restorative justice are eminently biblical. And the Bible then is also a touchstone whereby we can evaluate the modern phenomenon of restorative justice. You see, for all the ostensible similarities between the biblical laws of restitution and current premises of restorative justice, the two are not identical. Let me mention a few important differences. One difference is that in the Bible, restitution had limited applicability. It was not, for example, prescribed for violent crimes such as murder. Leviticus 24 says, "Whoever kills an animal must make restitution, but whoever kills a human must be put to death." In Numbers 35, we read, "Do not accept a ransom for the life of a murderer who deserves to die. He must surely be put to death." In other words, the cost of human life is too high for an offender to repay except with his own life. The Old Testament also prescribed the death penalty for adultery. Now, I say this not to argue that capital punishment should be reinstated, but simply to caution that we should not expect too much from restorative justice. There is a place for prisons, especially to incapacitate offenders who are violent and dangerous. Reflecting on this, I must say, I'm impressed with the optimism and energy with which proponents of restorative justice are investigating its application to all kinds of cases, including serious and violent crimes. However, the laws of Scripture give a more realistic picture and make us sober about our ability to restore. Often, the loss that a victim has experienced is too great for even the most contrite offender to repay. The wounds are simply too deep for even the most skillfully mediated sentencing circles to repair. That leads me to a second observation. Proponents of the restorative model tend to assume an antithetical stance over against the punitive model of criminal justice, as though it's either one or the other. However, the Old Testament laws include both. For example, Deuteronomy 13 says that those who tried to persuade the Israelites to serve false gods were to be executed. And why? The reason given was that so that all Israel will hear and be afraid, and no one among you will do such an evil thing again. I mention this example again not to advocate the death penalty for blasphemy today, but to show that the Bible includes both punitive and restorative principles of justice. Ecclesiastes 8 promotes speedy justice as a deterrent to criminals. It says there, When the sentence for a crime is not quickly carried out, the hearts of the people are filled with schemes to do wrong. So again, deterrence has a significant role in Old Testament law. Think back for a moment as well to the law that I mentioned earlier that required a thief to pay back 5 head of cattle for an ox or 4 sheep for a sheep. Now you can imagine that such a generous restitution would help the victim to move past the crime and put aside his anger towards the thief. In the end, he has more than he lost. On the other hand, such a law would also be a deterrent for the thief who would think twice before stealing again. It was going to cost him. So the biblical model of restorative justice includes deterrence. I believe that in our society as well, there is a place for both the restorative and the punitive models. Much as I applaud the new sentencing objectives that have been added to the Criminal Code in 1996, namely, to provide reparation for harm done to victims or to the community, and to promote a sense of responsibility in offenders, and acknowledgement of the harm done to victims and to the community, I would not want those new objectives to replace the other ones, to denounce unlawful conduct, to deter the offender and other persons from committing offenses, to separate offenders from society where necessary. Those objectives remain crucial for maintaining justice and order in society. Now, in fairness, I suspect that proponents of restorative justice would agree. They recognize that the restorative process sometimes fails because a victim or an offender simply don't want to go through the process, or because efforts at reaching an agreement run stuck and cooperation proves impossible. Thirdly, perhaps the most important difference between the Old Testament laws of restitution and principles of restorative justice today is that the Bible treats crime not only in terms of harm done to victims and their communities, but it treats crime also as offense against God. For example, on the very day that a thief made restitution to his neighbor, he also had to bring a guilt offering to the priest. As Leviticus 6 puts it, the priest will make atonement for him before the Lord, and he will be forgiven. So crime always has a spiritual aspect. The godliest ruler of Israel, King David, slept with another man's wife and arranged to have her husband murdered. How do you ever move past a crime like that? Well, David prayed for forgiveness and restoration, and the Bible gives us his prayer in Psalm 51. He said, "Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation." So this is an acknowledgement that true restoration cannot be achieved by human effort, but only as a divine answer to prayer. In the well-known words of Alexander Pope, "To err is human, to forgive divine." And in the immortal words of Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd, he restores my soul." As much as restorative justice endeavors to address the spiritual wounds that have been left by crime, restorative justice cannot overcome the very real guilt and shame that results from offending God. It does not address that spiritual wound. It doesn't then restore the whole person. It's simply not equipped to do so. So Scripture makes us sober about the ability of restorative justice to move an offender to remorse, or a victim to compassion and love. To generate love for one's enemy is an ideal that's beyond the power of the justice system to achieve. My intent in saying this is not to denigrate the very valuable results that the restorative process can yield, no, but it's simply to identify a limitation. If this limitation is acknowledged, then opportunity can be given to others who are equipped to fill the gap. And here I think particularly of churches who have been entrusted with the ministry of reconciliation and who can therefore complement the restorative process with the message of repentance, forgiveness, and grace. In closing, I'd like to offer four short reflections. Number one, when considering criminal legislation, Canada's lawmakers should continue to pay close attention to the worthwhile perspectives and very real contributions of restorative justice. However much our constituencies might clamor for stiffer penalties, bigger jails, and longer prison sentences, these are not the only answers, nor even the best ones. Separating offenders from society is only one of the six objectives of sentencing that are mentioned in the Criminal Code. And Section 718 there says that it should be used only when necessary. Society should, of course, be protected from violent and dangerous offenders. But incarceration should not become the default response to criminal activity. Alternative options such as probation, fines, conditional sentences, and restitution orders should be fully explored. When offenders are imprisoned, their prison sentences could include a restorative component. For example, this is only a suggestion, but one might explore the possibility of giving prisoners meaningful work with pay, and then using some of that pay to help with restitution payments, family support payments, and investing in education. The goal is to promote a sense of personal responsibility in offenders and to create a venue for restoring relationships in the community. In short, the criminal justice system should continue to acknowledge the wounds that need to be healed and the relationships that need to be restored. Number two, a biblical understanding of restorative justice does not tilt the balance away from holding offenders responsible for their actions. It is not soft on crime. Quite the opposite. It confronts offenders with the damage that their actions have caused. It encourages them to take responsibility, and it provides a mechanism for reparation and healing to begin. Restorative justice works to maintain the balance between punishment and individual responsibility on the one hand, and reparation and healing on the other. And as such, it deserves our thoughtful support. Number three, whatever its merits, restorative justice is not a panacea, nor will it usher in a utopia. It does not have the power to remove guilt towards God, nor the power to repair the broken condition of human hearts. It aims to repair deep emotional, relational, and spiritual wounds. Such restoration is crucial, to be sure. But it goes beyond the role and the capabilities of the state. Restorative justice is therefore a forum where church and state can work side by side for the restoration of the whole person and of harmony in society, each respecting the jurisdiction of the other. But full restoration and perfect justice will only come at the end of time when Jesus Christ comes back as judge to make everything right. Fourth and finally, to our Christian citizens. As Christians, we often find ourselves inclined to bemoan the erosion of biblical values in our land. With such a mindset, we might very well become blind to the positive developments that are sitting right under our very noses. If, on the other hand, we look for the positives, we might just be surprised at what we find. I think that restorative justice is a case in point. It offers a wonderful opportunity for prayer and work. May God bless us all with much wisdom as we strive to build our nation upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law. Thank you.
This has been Lighthouse News, shining the light of biblical truth on today's current events. Production Manager, Mark Penninga. Technical Director, Nate Bosher. Questions or feedback, email info@artbegcanada.ca. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks for another edition of Lighthouse News.